St. Thomas Aquinas, Part 2. For instance, it was a very special idea of St. Thomas that man is to be studied in his whole manhood, that a man is not a man without his body, just as he is not a man without his soul. A corpse is not a man, but also a ghost is not a man. The earlier school of Augustine, and even of Anselm, had rather neglected this, treating the soul as the only necessary treasure, wrapped for a time in a negligible napkin. Even here they were less orthodox in being more spiritual. They sometimes hovered on the edge of those eastern deserts that stretch away to the land of transmigration, where the essential soul may pass through 100 unessential bodies, reincarnated even in the bodies of beasts and birds. St. Thomas stood up stoutly for the fact that a man's body is his body as his mind is his mind, and that he can only be a balance and a union of the two. Very near to the modern respect for material things, a praise of the body that might be sung by Walt Whitman or justified by D.H. Lawrence, a thing that might be called humanism or even claimed by modernism. In fact, it may be materialism, but it is the flat contrary of modernism. It is bound up, in the modern view, with that most monstrous, most material, and therefore the most miraculous of miracles. It is specially connected with the most startling sort of dogma, which the modernist can least accept, the resurrection of the body. Or again, his argument for revelation is quite rationalistic, and, on the other side, decidedly democratic and popular. His argument for revelation is not in the least an argument against reason. On the contrary, he seems inclined to admit that truth could be reached by a rational process, if only it were rational enough, and also long enough. Indeed, something in his character, which I have called elsewhere optimism, and for which I know no other approximate term, led him rather to exaggerate the extent to which all men would ultimately listen to reason. In his controversies, he always assumes that they will listen to reason. That is, he does emphatically believe that men can be convinced by argument when they reach the end of the argument. Only his common sense also told him that the argument never ends. I might convince a man that matter, as the origin of mind, is quite meaningless. If he and I were very fond of each other and fought each other every night for 40 years. But long before he was convinced on his deathbed, 1,000 other materialists could have been born, so nobody can explain everything to everybody. St. Thomas takes the view that the souls of all the ordinary hard-working and simple-minded people are quite as important as the soul of thinkers and truth-seekers. And he asks how all these people are possibly to find time for the amount of reasoning that is needed to find truth. The whole tone of the passage shows both a respect for scientific inquiry and a strong sympathy with the average man. His argument for revelation is not an argument against reason, but it is an argument for revelation. The conclusion he draws from it is that men must receive the highest moral truths in a miraculous manner. Most men would not receive them at all. His arguments are rational and natural, but his own deduction is all for the supernatural. And, as is common in the case of his argument, it is not easy to find any deduction except his own deduction. And when we come to that, we find it is something as simple as St. Francis himself could desire. The message from heaven, the story that is told out of the sky, the fairy tale that is really true. It is plainer still in more popular problems like free will. If St. Thomas stands for one thing more than another, it is what may be called subordinate sovereignties or autonomies. He was, if the flippancy may be used, a strong home ruler. We might even say he was always defending the independence of the dependent things. He insists that such a thing could have its own rights in its own region. It was his attitude to the home rule of the reason and even the senses. Daughter, am I in my father's house, but mistress in my own. In exactly this sense, he emphasized a certain dignity in man, which was sometimes rather swallowed up in the purely theistic generalizations about God. Nobody would say he wanted to divine man from God, but he did want to distinguish man from God. In this strong sense of human dignity and liberty, there is much more that can be and is appreciated now as a noble humanistic liberality. But let us not forget that its upshot was that very free will, or moral responsibility of man, which so many modern liberals would deny. Upon this sublime and perilous liberty hang heaven and hell, and all the mysterious drama of the soul. It is distinction and not division, but a man can divide himself from God, which, in a certain aspect, is the greatest distinction of all. Again, though it is more a metaphysical matter, which must be mentioned later, and then only slightly, it is the same with the old philosophical dispute about the many and the one. Are things so different that they can never be classified, or so unified that they can never be distinguished? Without pretending to answer such questions here, we may say broadly that St. Thomas comes down definitely on the side of variety, as a thing that is real as well as unity. In this, and questions akin to this, he often departs from the great Greek philosophers who were sometimes his models, and entirely departs from the great Oriental philosophers who are in some sense his rivals. He seems fairly certain that the difference between chalk and cheese, or pigs and pelicans, is not mere illusion, or dazzle of our bewildered mind blinded by a single light, but is pretty much what we all feel it to be. It may be said that this is mere common sense, the common sense that pigs are pigs. To that extent related to the earthbound, Aristotelian common sense, to a human and even a heathen common sense. But note that here again the extremes of earth and heaven meet. It is also connected with the dogmatic Christian idea of creation, of a creator who created pigs, as distinct from a cosmos that merely evolved them. In all these cases, we see repeated the point stated at the start. The Thomist movement in metaphysics, like the Franciscan movement in morals and manners, was an enlargement and an liberation. It was emphatically a growth of Christian theology from within. It was emphatically not a shrinking of Christian theology under heathen or even human influences. The Franciscan was free to be a friar instead of being bound to be a monk. But he was more of a Christian, more of a Catholic, even more of an ascetic. So the Thomist was free to be an Aristotelian instead of being bound to be an Augustinian. But he was even more of a theologian, more of an orthodox theologian, more of a dogmatist, in having recovered through Aristotle the most defiant of all dogmas, the wedding of God with man, and therefore with matter. Nobody can understand the greatness of the 13th century who does not realize that it was a great growth in new things produced by a living thing. In what sense it was really bolder and freer than what we call the Renaissance, which was a resurrection of old things discovered in a dead thing. In that sense, medievalism was not a Renaissance, but rather a nascence. It did not model its temples upon the tombs, or call up dead gods from Hades. It made an architecture as new as modern engineering. Indeed, it still remains the most modern architecture. Only it was followed at the Renaissance by a more antiquated architecture. In that sense, the Renaissance might be called the relapse. Whatever may be said of the Gothic and the Gospel according to St. Thomas, they were not a relapse. It was a new thrust, like the Titanic thrust of Gothic engineering, and its strength was in a God who makes all things new. In a word, St. Thomas was making Christendom more Christian by making it more Aristotelian. This is not a paradox, but a plain truism, which can only be missed by those who may know what it is meant by an Aristotelian, but have simply forgotten what is meant by a Christian. As compared with a Jew, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a deist, or most obvious alternatives, a Christian means a man who believes that deity or sanctity has attached to matter or entered the world of the senses. Some modern writers, missing this simple point, have even talked as if the acceptance of Aristotle was a sort of concession to the Arabs, like a modernist vicar making a concession to the agnostics. They might well as say that the Crusades were a concession to the Arabs, as say that Aquinas rescuing Aristotle from Averroes was a concession to the Arabs. The Crusaders wanted to recover the place where the body of Christ had been, because they believed, rightly or wrongly, that it was a Christian place. St. Thomas wanted to recover what was in essence the body of Christ itself, the sanctified body of the Son of Man, which had become a miraculous medium between heaven and earth. He wanted the body and all its senses because he believed, rightly or wrongly, that it was a Christian thing. It might be a humbler or homelier thing than the Platonic mind, that is why it was Christian. St. Thomas was, if you will, taking the lower road when he walked in the steps of Aristotle. So was God when he worked in the workshop of Joseph. Lastly, these two great men were not only united to each other, but separated from most of their comrades and contemporaries by the very revolutionary character of their own revolution. In 1215, Dominic Guzman, the Castilian, founded an order very similar to that of Francis, and, by a most curious coincidence of history, at almost exactly the same moment as Francis. It was directed primarily to preaching the Catholic philosophy to the Albigensian heretics, whose own philosophy was one of the many forms of that Manichaeism with which the story is much concerned. It had its roots in the remote mysticism and moral detachment of the East. It was therefore inevitable that the Dominicans should be rather more a brotherhood of philosophers, where the Franciscans were by comparison a brotherhood of poets. For this and other reasons, St. Dominic and his fathers were little known or understood in modern England. They were involved eventually in a religious war, which followed on a theological argument that there was something in the atmosphere of our country during the last century or so, which made the theological argument even more incomprehensible than the religious war. The ultimate effect is in some ways curious, because St. Dominic, even more than St. Francis, was marked by that intellectual independence and strict standard of virtue and veracity, which Protestant cultures are wont to regard as specially Protestant. It was of him that the tale was told, and would certainly have been told more widely among us, as if it had been told of a Puritan, that the Pope pointed to his gorgeous papal palace and said, "Peter can no longer say, 'Silver and gold have I none,' and the Spanish friar answered, 'No, and neither can he now say, rise and walk.'" There is another way in which the popular story of St. Francis can be a sort of bridge between the modern and medieval world, and it is based on that very fact already mentioned, that St. Francis and St. Dominic stand together in history as having done the same work, and yet are divided in English popular tradition in the most strange and startling way. In their own lands, they are like heavenly twins, irradiating the same light from heaven, seeming sometimes to be two saints in one halo, as another order depicted Holy Poverty as two knights on one horse. In the legends of our own land, they are about as much united as St. George and the Dragon. Dominic is still conceived as an inquisitor devising thumbscrews, while Francis is already accepted as a humanitarian deploring mouse traps. It seems, for instance, quite natural to us, and full of the same associations of flowers and starry fancies, but the name of Francis should belong to Francis Thompson. But I fancy it would seem less natural to call him Dominic Thompson, or find that a man with a long record of popular sympathies and practical tenderness to the poor could bear such a name as Dominic Plater. It would sound as if he had been called Torquemada Thompson. Now there must be something wrong behind this contradiction. Turning those who were allies at home into antagonists abroad, on any other question, the fact would be apparent to common sense. Suppose English liberals or free traders found that, in remote parts of China, it was generally held that Cobden was a cruel monster, but Bright a stainless saint. They would think there was a mistake somewhere. Suppose that American evangelicals learned that in France or Italy, or other civilizations impenetrable by Moody and Sankey, there was a popular belief that Moody was an angel, but Sankey a devil. They would guess that there must be a muddle somewhere. Some other later accidental distinctions must have cut across the main course of a historical tendency. These parallels are not so fantastic as they may sound. Cobden and Bright may actually have been called child torturers in anger at their alleged callousness about the evils amended by the Factory Acts. And some would call the Moody and Sankey sermon on hell a hellish exhibition. All that is a matter of opinion, but both men held the same sort of opinion, that there must be a blunder in an opinion that separates them so completely. And of course there is a complete blunder in the legend about Saint Dominic. Those who know anything about Saint Dominic knew that he was a missionary and not a militant persecutor, that his contribution to religion was the rosary and not the rack, that his whole career is meaningless, unless we understand that his famous victories were victories of persuasion and not persecution. He did believe in the justification of persecution, in the sense that the secular arm could repress religious disorders. So did everybody else believe in persecution, and none of them more than the elegant blasphemer Frederick II, who believed in nothing else. Some say he was the first to burn heretics. But anyhow, he thought it was the one of his imperial privileges and duties to persecute heretics. But to talk as if Dominic did nothing but persecute heretics is like blaming Father Matthew, who persuaded millions of drunkards to take a temperance pledge, because the accepted law sometimes allowed a drunkard to be arrested by a policeman. It is to miss the whole point, which is that this particular man had a genius for conversion, quite apart from compulsion. The real difference between Francis and Dominic, which is no discredit to either of them, is that Dominic did happen to be confronted with a huge campaign for the conversion of heretics, while Francis only had the more subtle task of the conversion of human beings. It is an old story that, while we may need somebody like Dominic to convert the heathen to Christianity, we are even greater need of somebody like Francis to convert the Christians to Christianity. Still, we must not lose sight of Saint Dominic's special problem, which was that of dealing with a whole population, kingdoms and cities and countrysides, that had drifted from the faith and solidified into strange and abnormal new religions. That he did win back masses of men so deceived, merely by talking and preaching, remains an enormous triumph worthy of a colossal trophy. Saint Francis is called humane because he tried to convert the Saracens and failed. Saint Dominic is called bigoted and besotted because he tried to convert the Albigensians and succeeded. But we happen to be in a curious nook or corner of the hills of history, from which we can see Assisi and the Umbrian Hills, but are out of sight of the vast battlefield of the Southern Crusade, the miracle of Muret, and the greater miracle of Dominic, when the routes of the Pyrenees and the shores of the Mediterranean saw defeated the Asiatic despair. But there is an earlier and more essential link between Dominic and Francis, which is more to the immediate purpose of this book. They were in later times bracketed in glory because they were in their own time bracketed in infamy, or at least in unpopularity. For they did the most unpopular thing that men can do. They started a popular movement. A man who dares to make a direct appeal to the populace always makes a long series of enemies, beginning with the populace. In proportion as the poor begin to understand that he means to help and not hurt them, the solid classes above begin to close in, resolved to hinder and not help. The rich, and even the learned, sometimes feel not unreasonably that the things will change the world, not only in its worldliness or its worldly wisdom, but to some extent perhaps in its real wisdom. Such a feeling was not unnatural in his case. When we consider, for instance, Saint Francis's really reckless attitude about rejecting books and scholarship, or that tendency that the friars afterward showed to appeal to the Pope in contempt of local bishops and ecclesiastical officers. In short, Saint Dominic and Saint Francis created a revolution quite as popular and unpopular as the French Revolution. But it is very hard today to feel that even the French Revolution was as fresh as it really was. The Marseillaise once sounded like the human voice of the volcano, or the dance tune of the earthquake, and the kings of the earth trembled, some fearing that the heavens might fall, some fearing far more than justice might be done. The Marseillaise is played today at diplomatic dinner parties, where smiling monarchs meet beaming millionaires, and is rather less revolutionary than Home Sweet Home. Also, it is highly pertinent to recall the modern revolutionists would now call the revolt of the French Jacobins insufficient, just as they would call the revolt of the friars insufficient. They would say that neither went far enough, but many, in their own day, thought they went in very much too far. In the case of the friars, the higher orders of the state, and to some extent even of the church, were profoundly shocked at such a loosening of wild popular preachers among the people. It is not at all easy for us to feel that distant events were thus disconcerting and even disreputable. Revolutions turn into institutions, revolts that renew the youth of old societies in their turn grow cold. And the past, which was full of new things, of splits and innovations and insurrections, seemed to us a single texture of tradition. But if we wish for one fact that will make vivid this shock of change and challenge, and show how raw and ragged and almost rowdy in its reckless novelty, how much of the gutter and how remote from refined life this experiment of the friars did really seem to many in its own day, there is here a very relevant fact to reveal it. It shows how much a settled and already ancient Christendom did feel it as something like the end of an age, and how the very roads of the earth seemed to shake under the feet of the new and nameless army, the march of the beggars. A mystic nursery rhyme suggests the atmosphere of such a crisis. Hark, hark, the dogs do bark, the beggars are coming to town. There were many towns that almost fortified themselves against them, and many watchdogs of property and rank really did bark and hark loudly when those beggars went by. But louder was the singing of the beggars who sang their canticle to the sun, and louder the baying of the hounds of heaven. The domini canis of the medieval pun, the dogs of God. And it would measure how real and rending seemed that revolution. What a break with the past! We can see it in the first and most extraordinary event in the life of St. Thomas Aquinas. Chapter 2. The Runaway Abbot. Thomas Aquinas, in a strange and rather symbolic manner, sprang out of the very center of the civilized world of his time, the central knot or coil of the powers then controlling Christendom. He was closely connected with all of them, even with some of them that might well be described as destroying Christendom. The whole religious quarrel, the whole international quarrel, was for him a family quarrel. He was born in the purple, almost literally on the hem of the imperial purple, for his own cousin was the Holy Roman Emperor. He could have quartered half the kingdoms of Europe on his shield, if he had not thrown away the shield. He was Italian and French and German, and in every way European. On one side, he inherited from the energy that made the episode of the Normans, whose strange organizing raids rang and rattled like flights of arrows in the corners of Europe and the ends of the earth. One flight of them followed Duke William far northward through the blinding snows to Chester. Another treading in Greek and Punic footsteps through the island of Sicily to the gates of Syracuse. Another bond of blood bound him to the great emperors of the Rhine and Danube, who claimed to wear the crown of Charlemagne. Red Barbarossa, who sleeps under the rushing river, was his great uncle, and Frederick II, the wonder of the world, his second cousin. And yet he held, by 100 more intimate ties to the lively inner life, the local vivacity, the little walled nations, and the thousand shrines of Italy. While inheriting this physical kinship with the emperor, he maintained far more firmly his spiritual kinship with the Pope. He understood the meaning of Rome, and in that sense, it was still ruling the world. It was not likely to think that the German emperors of his time, any more than the Greek emperors of a previous time, would be able to be really Roman in defiance of Rome. To this cosmopolitan comprehensiveness in his inherited position, he afterwards added many things of his own that made for mutual understanding among the peoples, and gave him something of the character of an ambassador and interpreter. He traveled a great deal. He was not only well enough in Paris and the German universities, but he almost certainly visited England. Probably he went to Oxford and London, and it has been said that we may be treading in the footsteps of him and his Dominican companions. Whenever we go down by the river to the railway station that still bears the name of Blackfriars, but the truth applies to his travels of his mind as well as his body, he studied the literature even of the opponents of Christianity much more carefully and impartially than was then the fashion. He really tried to understand the Arabian Aristotelism of the Moslems, and wrote a highly humane and reasonable treatise on the problem of the treatment of Jews. He was always tempted to look at everything from the inside, but he was certainly lucky in having been born in the inside of the state system and the high politics of his day. What he thought of them may perhaps be inferred from the next passage in his history. St. Thomas might thus stand very well for the international man, to borrow the title of a modern book. But it is only fair to remember that he lived in the international age, in a world that was international in a sense not to be suggested in any modern book, or by any modern man. If I remember right, the modern candidate for the post of international man was Cobden, who was an abnormally national man, a narrowly national man, a very fine type, but one which can hardly be imagined except as moving between Midhurst and Manchester. He had an international policy, and he indulged in international travel. But if he always remained a national person, it was because he remained a normal person. That is normal to the 19th century. But it was not so in the 13th century. There was a man of international influence, like Cobden, could be almost a man of international nationality. The names of nations and cities and places of origin did not connote that deep division that is the mark of the modern world. Aquinas, as a student, was nicknamed the Ox of Sicily, though his birthplace was near Naples. But this did not prevent the city of Paris regarding him as simply and solidly as Parisian, because he had been a glory of the Sorbonne. That it proposed to bury his bones when he was dead, or take a more obvious contrast with modern times. Consider what is meant in most modern talk by a German professor, and then realize that the greatest of all German professors, Albertus Magnus, was himself one of the glories of the University of Paris, and it was Paris that Aquinas supported him. Think of the modern German professor being famous throughout Europe for his popularity when lecturing in Paris. Thus, if there was war in Christendom, it was international war in the special sense in which we speak of international peace. It was not the war of two nations, but the war of two internationalisms, of two world states, the Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire. The political crisis in Christendom affected the life of Aquinas at the start in one sharp disaster, and afterwards in many indirect ways. It had many elements. The Crusades, the embers of the Albigensian pessimism over which St. Dominic had triumphed in argument and Simon de Montfort in arms, the dubious experiment of an Inquisition which started from it, and many other things. But, broadly speaking, it is the period of the great duel between the popes and the emperors, that is, the German emperors who called themselves Holy Roman Emperors, the House of Hohenstaufen. The particular period of the life of Aquinas, however, is entirely overshadowed by the particular emperor who was himself more an Italian than German, the brilliant Frederick II, who was called the Wonder of the World. It may be reminded, in passing, that Latin was the most living of languages at this time, and we often feel a certain weakness in the necessary translation, for I seem to have read somewhere that the word used was stronger than Wonder of the World, and that his medieval title was Stupor Mundi, which is more exactly the stupefaction of the world. Something of the sort may be noted later of philosophical language, and the weakness of translating words like ens by a word like being. But for the moment the parentheses have another application, for it might well be said that Frederick did indeed stupefy the world, that there was something stunning and blinding about the blows he struck at religion, as in that blow which almost begins the biography of Thomas Aquinas. We may also be called stupefying in another sense, in that his very brilliancy has made some of his modern admirers very stupid. For Frederick II is the first figure, and that a rather fierce and ominous figure, who rides across the scene of his cousin's birth and boyhood, a scene of wild fighting and of fire. And it may be allowable to pause for a parenthesis upon his name for two particular reasons. First, that his romantic reputation, even among modern historians, covers and partly conceals the true background of the times, and the second that the tradition in question directly involves the whole status of St. Thomas Aquinas. The 19th century view, still so strangely called the modern view by many moderns, touching such a man as Frederick II, as well summed up by some solid Victorian, I think Macaulay, Frederick was a statesman in the age of crusaders, a philosopher in an age of monks. It may be noted that the antithesis invoked the assumption that a crusader cannot easily be a statesman, and that a monk cannot easily be a philosopher. Yet, to take only that special instance, it would be easy to point out that the cases of two famous men in the age of Frederick II would alone be strong enough to upset both the assumption and the antithesis. St. Louis, though a crusader, and even an unsuccessful crusader, was really a far more successful statesman than Frederick II. By the test of practical politics, he popularized, solidified, and sanctified the most powerful government in Europe, the order and concentration of the French monarchy, the single dynasty that steadily increased its strength for 500 years up to the glory of the Grand Siecle, whereas Frederick went down in ruin before the papacy and the republics, and a vast combination of priests and peoples. The Holy Roman Empire he wished to found was an ideal rather in the sense of a dream. It was certainly never a fact like the square and solid state which the French statesman did found. Or, to take another example from the next generation, one of the most strictly practical statesmen in history, our own Edward I, was also a crusader. The other half of the antithesis is even more false, and here even more relevant. Frederick II was not a philosopher in the age of monks. He was a gentleman dabbling in philosophy in the age of the monk Thomas Aquinas. He was doubtless an intelligent and even brilliant gentleman, but if he did leave any notes on the nature of being and becoming, or the precise sense in which realities can be relative to reality, I do not imagine these notes are now exciting undergraduates at Oxford or literary men in Paris, let alone the little groups of Thomists who have already sprung up even in New York and Chicago. It is no disrespect to the emperor to say that he certainly was not a philosopher in the sense in which Thomas Aquinas was a philosopher, let alone so great or so universal or so permanent a philosopher. And Thomas Aquinas lived in that very age of monks, and in that very world of monks, which Macaulay talks of as if it were incapable of producing philosophy. We need not dwell on the causes of this Victorian prejudice, which some still think so well advanced. It arose mainly from the narrow and or insular notion that no man could possibly be building up the best of the modern world if he went with the main movement of the medieval world. These Victorians thought that only the heretic had ever helped humanity. Only the man who nearly wrecked medieval civilization could be of any use in constructing modern civilization. Hence came a score of comic fables, as that the cathedrals must have been built by a secret society of Freemasons, or the Epic of Dante must be a cryptogram referring to the political hopes of Garibaldi. But the generalization is not in its nature probable, and it is not, in fact, true. The medieval period was rather specifically the period of communal or corporate thinking, and in some matters it was really rather larger than the individualistic modern thinking. This could be proved in a flash from the mere fact of the use of the word statesman. To a man of Macaulay's period, the statesman always meant a man who maintained a more narrow national interest of his own state against other states, as Richelieu maintained those of France, Chatham of England, Bismarck of Prussia. But if a man actually wanted to defend all these states, to combine all these states, to make a living brotherhood of all these states, to resist some outer peril, as from the Mongolian millions, then a poor devil, of course, could not really be called a statesman. He was only a crusader. In this way, it is but fair to Frederick II to say that he was a crusader, if he was rather like an anti-crusader. Certainly he was an international statesman. Indeed, he was a particular type, which may be called an international soldier. The international soldier is always very much disliked by internationalists. They dislike Charlemagne and Charles V and Napoleon, and everybody who tried to create the world state, for which they cry aloud day and night. But Frederick is more dubious and less doubted. He was supposed to be the head of the Holy Roman Empire, and accused of wanting to be the head of a very unholy Roman Empire. But even if he were Antichrist, he would still be a witness to the unity of Christendom. Nevertheless, there is a queer quality in that time, which, while it was international, was also internal and intimate. War, in the wide modern sense, is possible not because more men disagree, but because more men agree. Under the peculiarly modern coercion, such as compulsory education and conscription, there are such very large peaceful areas that they can all agree upon war. In that age, men disagreed even about war, and peace might break out anywhere. Peace was interrupted by feuds, and feuds by pardons. Individuality wound in and out of a maze. Spiritual extremes were walled up with one another in one little walled town. And we see the great soul of Dante divided, a cloven flame, loving and hating his own city. This individual complexity is intensely vivid in the particular story we have here to tell, in a very rough outline. If anyone wishes to know what is meant by saying that action was more individual, and indeed incalculable, he may well note that some stages in his story of the great feudal house of Aquino, which had its castle not far from Naples, in the mere hasty anecdote we have now to tell, we shall note in succession 5 or 6 stages of this sort. Landulf of Aquino, a heavy feudal fighter typical of the times, rode in armor behind the imperial banners and attacked a monastery because the emperor regarded the monastery as a fortress held for his enemy, the Pope. Later we shall see the same feudal lord send his own son to the same monastery, perhaps on the friendly advice of the same pope. Later still, another of his sons, entirely on his own, rebelled against the emperor and went over to the armies of the pope. For this he was executed by the emperor with a promptitude and dispatch. I wish we knew more about that brother of Thomas Aquinas who risked and lost his life to support the cause of the Pope, which was in all human essentials the cause of the people. He may not have been a saint, but he must have had some qualities of a martyr. Meanwhile, two other brothers, still ardent and actively apparent in the service of the emperor who killed the third brother, themselves proceeded to kidnap another brother because they did not approve of his sympathy with the new social movement and religion. That is the sort of tangle in which this one distinguished medieval family found itself. It was not a war of nations, but rather a widespread family quarrel.